Good afternoon. Good afternoon and welcome to the MSU Libraries. My name is Peter Berg. I am head of special collections here in the library. And I know Don Yates is very excited to see all of you here today. I am very relieved to see all of you here today because, as you may know, at the last minute, not the exact last minute, but in the last several days, we had to change the venue. For some logistic reasons, we had it over the International Center. But as the date got closer, we realized that nobody does events like this better than the MSU Libraries, in part because of John Shaw, who was over here, but also because of this wonderful room. And so that's why I'm relieved to see all of you here and that the message got out. In hindsight, also, it's only fitting that Don Yates' homecoming is here at the MSU Libraries, because for many years as professor of Spanish at MSU, Don had a wonderful and productive relationship with the MSU Library, and with particular the director, Dick Chapin, and head of collections, the late, great Henry Koch. Yeah. And so it's only fitting that that Don is here. He was instrumental in securing the acquisition of a distinguished Borges collection, which
First
Don
edition.
And I will look at again
First
tomorrow
edition.
In special collections, and we're delighted, of course, to have that here. He also donated a wonderful mystery writers collection, the Branson collection, to special collections. So the relationship between the MSU Libraries and Don Yates goes back for many years. So we're delighted that he's here, and I'm relieved that you're here. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce to you Professor of French, Michael Kopisch, here at MSU, who will formally introduce you to Don Yates and update you on what he's been up to since he's left MSU.
It gives me great pleasure to introduce to you my colleague and friend, Don Yates. Don has had a long and rich association with Michigan State University. After completing his doctorate at the University of Michigan, he joined our faculty to teach Spanish literature and published some of his most important work while in East Lansing. His creative and scholarly writing have garnered for him a Fulbright research grant and a Fulbright teaching fellowship, both in Argentina, where he is a well-known presence, a translation grant from the National Endowment of the Arts, and most recently, a John Simon Guggenheim Fellowship for his biography cum personal memoir of Jorge Luis Borges. He has lectured widely in Argentina, as well as in Uruguay, Chile, and Peru. After he retired, Don moved to California and has continued to be an extremely active scholar, translator, and writer. I suspect that the years in California have also provided the opportunity for some good adventures in wine. But this is probably not the place to go into that. Don first encountered the work of Borges back in 1954 when he read the great Argentine writer in a course taught by the legendary man of letters and literary critic Enrique Anderson Imbert. A budding author himself, Don thought to translate into English some of the work of this writer who had so deeply impressed him. Borges gave his permission for the translation, and the rest is history. Albeit, like all good history, history with a story attached to it. For no one was really interested in the excellent translation that Don and his colleague James Irby had done until New Directions agreed in 1962 to publish what has since probably become one of its best-selling, and certainly, for those of us with a literary turn of mind, most important volumes. Labyrinth, Selected Writings of Jorge Luis Borges. That book was my own introduction to Borges, as it was and continues to be for thousands upon thousands of readers in the English-speaking world. When back in 1970, I found myself having accepted a job in the department of the scholar who was responsible for my acquaintance with the work of Borges, I had no idea what was in store for me, once again thanks to the generosity of Don Yates. Perhaps you can imagine what it was like for a very junior member of a department to walk down the hall, sit himself down in a chair in Don's office filled with books and memorabilia, and engage in long dialogues in French or English with Borges, by that time recognized as one of the major writers of 20th century literature. I am still amazed at my good fortune and grateful to the colleague who made it possible by bringing Borges to our campus on two different occasions, one of them for an entire term. By that time, Don and Borges had developed a close relationship, a real friendship, that was last until the author's death in 1986, and that would play a central role in Don's current and highly original biographical project on Borges. Don has translated other important Latin American writers, among them his teacher Anderson Imbert, and I'd be surprised if he had not, in the process of making their work known to Anglophone readers, befriended all of them as well. Readers who delight in studying great works of art and sharing with others what they have learned about them are inclined to prize scholars and their achievements. Few scholars, however, can claim to make it possible for us to read a writer whose work we could not otherwise experience. Don is among those who have done just that. The subject of his lecture this afternoon is Borges and MSU. Please join me in greeting Donald Yates.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Michael, and thank you, Peter. Peter is a moving force behind this because we began talking some. Am I hooked in all right? Everybody good? We started talking about the possibility of Mike coming back and remembering the marvelous times when we had Borges here. Not only two times, we brought him here four times. And I'll tell you about all that. He was very fond of Michigan State. And he asked for a title, and I didn't come up with anything imaginative. I said Borges and MSU or Borges and East Lansing, which are both descriptive and honest. But I had second thoughts that I haven't told Peter about. But I thought I might have called it the title of my biography of Borges, Magical Journey, because from his birth in 1899 up until the time when he lost his sight in the mid to late 50s, he had a intellectual journey through many countries, through many literatures, through many literary texts that is like nothing anyone has ever experienced before. I thought that might have been a good title. Then I thought again, well, since his life is laid out in my book in the form of a Garden of Forking Paths, which is the title of one of his stories, wherein Borges conceives of human existence as a garden in which forking paths continue to fork as you proceed. You make one turn, and you could not turn back because another turn is waiting for you. Borges' life is like that, was like that, and I began to see my own life in the same manner. So let's say that the lecture is going to be of Borges. It's going to be at his masterful concept of the labyrinth, and I'll do a little bit of publicity for my biography, Magical Journey. If you forgive me, I have to give you a little bit of my own biographical backsight, because my life took a couple of turns that inevitably led me to Borges. But had it taken one different turn, I would never have met him, would never have maybe even gone into Spanish. So let me give you a few minutes of background. I grew up in Ann Arbor. My folks moved there from the East Coast in 1937. And I did all my schooling there, grade school, elementary school, and then what they call junior high school back in those days. It's middle school now. And then the University of Michigan, bachelor's, and then the master's, and then a couple of years serving in the U.S. Army, and then back with the GI Bill, which was one of the wonderful things that I received in return for the 2 years that I gave to the U.S. Army from 51 to 53. I came back to grad school in 53 and had decided to specialize in Spanish. And here's how that happened. In 1943, I read a novel called The Chinese Orange Mystery. I wonder if anybody knows who the author was. Ellery Queen. And why I was ready for that book and why I changed my entire focus in reading to mystery stories. I don't know, but from 1943 on, I became a collector, a critic. I began writing my own stories and shared with my professor, Anderson Imbert, at Michigan, the love for the same genre because he, Anderson Imbert, was also a detective fiction writer. He was writing detective stories and stories of fantasy before Borges was. And so he and I got together, but only because this forking of a path had happened before. When I went to Michigan, I inscribed myself into the pre-law program. I did that because I had read about 20 or 30 Perry Mason novels by Earl Stanley Gardner. And I was determined that my career was going to lead me into courtroom criminal defense, and I was going to do all the wonderful things that Perry Mason did in every blooming book that he wrote. So I started up. And one of my early courses was something in English constitutional history or something. And the professor, Professor Nelson, noticed that I was not doing exactly distinguished work in that field, in that course. And he called me aside one day and said, I noticed that you're not doing really good work in this course, and I was expecting a lot from you. And I said, I'm sorry. It's nothing about you, but I find this material to be terribly dry and uninteresting and with no drama, no color. And I was expecting something that would at least keep me awake the way that Perry Mason did. And he said, what is your major? And I said, it's pre-law. And he said, oh. And he thought for a moment. He said, Mr. Yates, I need to tell you this. Before you finish the pre-law curriculum, you're going to have to get through a lot more courses like this one. And I said, well, I'm sorry, I'm disappointed to hear that. He said, let me give you a word of advice. I suggest that you go tomorrow to the administration building and change your major. I changed it to Spanish. And I would never have seen Anderson Imbert. And Anderson Imbert, in an early course in my graduate career when I was going for the MA, had his list of required reading. And on this list was a book called La Muerte y la Brújula. It's a collection of stories from several earlier books by Borges, stories that have a lot of adventure, a lot of color, a lot of drama, a espionage story, a crime story. And the book, the story that gave its title to the book, Death in the Compass, was absolutely astonishing. I had never read a detective short story like Death and the Compass. And by then, I had started translating Latin American mystery writers. Why not? I had Spanish, and I had the interest in Latin American literature. Nobody ever explored Latin American detective literature. So Anderson and I got together, and I did my dissertation with him. And after having read that story, Death in the Compass, I said, I would like to translate the story into English. And I said, I have a friend in Argentina. His name is Rodolfo Jorge Walsh, a writer of detective fiction, a critic of detective fiction, translator of detective fiction from English to Spanish, and he was my first Argentine friend. In 1953, he brought out a book called 10 Argentine Detective Stories, and I wrote to him, and he started sending me material to help me in my dissertation on the Argentine detective story. And I wrote to him. He talked very highly about Borges in our correspondence. And I said, I would like to translate Death in the Compass. And he said, well, what would you like me to do? And I said, I wonder if you get him to give me an authorization to translate that story. And he said, fine. He not only got in touch with him, he went over to visit Borges and gave me this sheet of paper with Borges' scratchy little authorization to translate Death in the Compass and any other story that I thought was of interest, plus any of the five stories called Seis Problemas para Don Isidro Parodi, Six Problems for Don Isidro Parodi, that he had written with his very close and brilliant literary friend, Adolfo Bioy Casares. So I had the authorization, and I did Death in the Compass. And started doing more stories. And the idea finally came to me, why not try to get a book of this man's extraordinary stories into print? So I started working on it, translating bit by bit. And by 1959, I had a pretty good group of stories, some by my own translation, some by others that were very good. And I happened to write to my friend, former colleague at Michigan, James Irby, who had done his dissertation on Borges also, and said I was doing a book. He says, well, I've been doing a lot of translation. I said, you did them to translate and publish? He said, no, I just want to do these stories to get a feel of Borges' style, a really intimate feel. And I said, I'd like to see them. He sent them. They were excellent. So when I finally got a contract with James Laughlin at New Directions, who says, I know a little bit about this guy, and I'll put my money on him. I said to Jim, join me, and we'll do Labyrinths. That was the title we decided for the book, together. So it was, and in 1962, New Directions published Labyrinths, Selected Stories of Jorge Luis de Borges, translated by James Irby, and Donald Yeats and others, with a preface by André Maurois, which gave the book a nice boost. Well, he was so pleased about the book that I'd offered him. He says, I'm going to do something that nobody does for translators. I'm going to give you a royalty percentage of the book, which in those days was totally unknown. Translators were slaves, and they would get so many dollars for so many pages, and that was it. The publisher bought the translation. You never saw a penny on it again. Jim Laughlin put me and Jim in on the payroll at New Directions. Well, by 1962, when the book came out, I had finished my dissertation. I had come to Michigan State in 57, and Anderson Imbert, after I finished his dissertation, said, I think you might profit by going to Argentina and studying literature of fantasy. And I said, fine, that's wonderful. He put in a letter, and they gave me a Fulbright. In 1962, I went to Buenos Aires, Argentina. The first day I was there, I went to the National Library, where Borges was the director, and met him for the first time. The secretary opened the door, and here was this mahogany furniture and wooden walls, and Borges was seated behind this huge semicircular desk, and he came up with a sort of holding his hands out. I said who I was, and he shook my hand. He says, of course, I know who you are. You have helped bring into print Labyrinths, my stories, and I thank you very much. I want to point out to you that you and your colleague both have improved my stories very much. I appreciate it. And I'm happy to see them in my favorite language, my preferred language, English. Well, it was the start of a friendship. I met a lot of Argentine writers. A lot of them were Borges' friends. And I had a very profitable year. I came back to Michigan State, taught in 63, 64. And then I had my sabbatical and went back to Buenos Aires. Spend more time with Borges. He seemed to be very happy to be in my company. He was quite capable of getting around by himself, practically totally blind, with just a cane through the streets downtown of Buenos Aires. And he was happy to do that, but he always preferred to have somebody accompany him. And I accompanied every place because I didn't have any other duties. I was just investigating literature. And we had a wonderful year, and I was beginning to learn so much about him that I decided to start gathering material about his life, perhaps for a biography. And he was totally in agreement with the idea. So that's what I started doing. And as I spent that year, 64, 65, in Buenos Aires, I started to make a portrait, a profile of Borges. And here are some of the things that I decided were qualities of that man. He was absolutely tireless as far as the physical use of his body was concerned. He never showed any weariness. He loved to go for walks, and walks for him were 7 or 8 miles through the streets of Argentina to Buenos Aires, out into the suburbs, back again. He was passionate and never tired. He had a tireless mind. He could not sit alone and let his mind go blank. He was constantly thinking, putting ideas together for poems, for stories, and I've never known anybody with that kind of energy of both kinds who was blind. He had a prodigious memory, extraordinary memory, and he would hear a poem once and be able to repeat it the next day. Complete. In French, in Spanish, in English. And these things, he was incapable of forgetting them. It was extraordinary. He had a special enjoyment for sharing the pleasures of reading with other people. He was completely hedonistic in his writing. If he started a book and didn't interest him, he put it aside. And that's counsel he gave to all of his students also. You may not be worthy of a book, or the book may not be worthy of you. But when he was a professor in Buenos Aires from 1955 on, his advice to students was don't read anything that you're not enjoying. So there was no concept of required reading in his classes, which opened up the minds and the possibilities of his students enormously, like perhaps no one else ever conceived was advisable or possible in a class. He would, when he was a boy, would try to share with other people his love of language. And he started reading very young, and he started reading very adult books. His father kept him and his sister, Nora, home for 6 years before he put them into a public school. And poor Georgie, when his father sent him to school, didn't send him to the English school where he can continue to study in English and speak English. Borges spoke English only with his father and Spanish with everybody else in the house. So his father put him in the local school in the outskirts of Buenos Aires in a place called Palermo, which is really on the outskirts of Buenos Aires then. So people of modest and lower category, and the kids he went to school with are a bunch of little hoodlums, and they had no background, no training. And Borges, who was sent by his mother and father to school with an Eton collar and a jacket and a tie, was made fun of terribly. And he would try to share with them, this is a constant quality in him, his joy in reading. And he'd say to his chums, for example, don't you think the Minotaur is a marvelous episode in Greek mythology? And or how about Huck Finn? Isn't that a great story? And he get no response. And then he tried something in Spanish, maybe, and he says, don't you think Quixote is the most marvelous book you've ever read? How about Martin Fierro? So, I mean, he was a target of a lot of abuse, and they started teaching him words, lunfardo and things like that, that he wasn't supposed to use. It was common coin for the kids living in this part of town in the hope that he would use them with the professor. He was made very uncomfortable because he had never had a playmate or a friend outside of his sister for those 6 years. Again, he was shy, always very shy, stammered, stuttered, which he never completely overcame, even when he became a lecturer in Buenos Aires. He was confident in his blindness, and he would walk around streets with just a cane and feel perfectly complete and alone. But he would prefer to have a person accompany him so he could take that person's arm. He never wanted anybody to take his arm. He would take that person's arm, and they could start talking without any distractions or any concerns. He had a sense of humor, a humor of concepts and not a humor of puns or jokes. He had no patience whatever with puns or jokes that are stories sort of build things. It's concepts. For example, he and a friend of his were going to go to a lecture by a really boring guy who had lectured all over Buenos Aires and felt he was very important. And they were going to go to the lecture to enjoy his pompousness and to see what the audience, how the audience reacted. And Borges had a conflict. And the next day, he called his friend and said to his friend, I'm sorry, I couldn't make the lecture. How was the turnout? How was the lecture? And his friend said to him, there were so few people there that if anybody else hadn't been able to come, he wouldn't have been able to get in. So playing with concepts and ideas are what really amused him, and he never found anything planned or the way we think of a joke. Jokes didn't amuse him. And puns didn't amuse him. I asked him why once. He said, because someone is having fun at the expense of not hearing your sense, but hearing your sound, which was insulting. He, poor fellow, had a need to be in love all the time. It was as if he couldn't breathe. If not, he would fall desperately in love with one woman after another. And certain women were pleased to be in his company, but to have him as a companion or a husband or a lover, he always ended up being left behind. And he was a passionate man, even though reading his stories, you wouldn't think this is not a passionate man. Borges, in his entire lifetime, never wrote anything in English or published anything in English except two poems that he wrote in the mid-40s to a woman he was deeply in love with and who had left him. And this is the only thing Borges ever wrote in English. I know with Norman Thomas DiGiovanni, his principal translator, he wrote his own autobiographical notes in English. But that was Norman's doing with Borges's feed-in. But this is one of two poems, love poems, that Borges wrote. What can I hold you with? I offer you lean streets, desperate sunsets, the moon of the jagged suburbs. I offer you the bitterness of a man who has looked long and long at the lonely moon. I offer you my ancestors, my dead men, the ghosts that living men have honored in marble, my father's father, killed in the frontier of Buenos Aires, two bullets through his lungs, bearded and dead and wrapped by his soldiers in the hide of a cow. My mother's grandfather, just 24, headed for a charge of 300 men in Peru, now ghosts on vanished horses. I offer you whatever insight my books may hold, whatever manliness or humor my life. I offer you the loyalty of a man who has never been loyal. I offer you that kernel of myself that I have saved somehow, the central heart that deals not in words, traffics not with dreams, and is untouched by time, by joy, by adversities. I offer you the memory of a yellow rose seen at sunset years before you were born. I offer you explanations of myself, of yourself, theories about yourself, authentic and surprising news of yourself. I can give you my loneliness, my darkness, the hunger of my heart. I am trying to bribe you with uncertainty, with danger, with defeat. The even when he's a very famous writer and known everywhere, he was extremely kind with strangers and never played the writer who must be adored and appreciated and so forth. Always kind with someone who would meet him and who would sense that the person was uncomfortable. He would always start the conversation and make some comment, for example, on that person's name or where he came from, and Borges would bring up something and start a conversation. So he was kind in treating people he didn't know very well. And maybe one of the really important things about his character was he was always interested, according to his mother, in what she called, in a very simple term, lo misterioso, things that are strange or mysterious. Examples would be concepts that you couldn't grasp. For example, infinity, eternity, metaphysics, religion, philosophy, identity. These are concepts that he was fascinated by because he kept investigating them, searching for some kind of answer to some question. And he was always involved in searching for things, could never be nailed down. Here is a page on identity, human identity, and Borges in 1960, at the end of his really most productive period from 1921 to 1960, wrote this page. Borges and I. The other one, the one called Borges, is the one things happen to. I walk through the streets of Buenos Aires and stop for a moment, perhaps mechanically now, to look at the arch of an entrance hall and the grill work on the gate. I know of Borges from the mail and see his name on a list of professors or in a biographical dictionary. I like hourglasses, maps, 18th-century topography, the taste of coffee, and the prose of Stevenson. He shares these preferences, but in a vain way that turns them into the attributes of an actor. It would be an exaggeration to say that ours is a hostile relationship. I live, let myself go on living, so that Borges may contrive his literature. And this literature justifies me. It is no effort for me to confess that he has achieved some valid pages, but those pages cannot save me, perhaps because what is good belongs to no one, not even to him, but rather to the language and to tradition. Besides, I am destined to perish definitively, and only some instant of myself will survive in him. Little by little, I am giving over everything to him, though I am quite aware of his perverse custom of falsifying and magnifying things. Spinoza knew that all things long to persist in their being. The stone eternally wants to be a stone, and the tiger a tiger. I shall remain in Borges, not in myself, if it is true that I am someone. But I recognize myself less in his books than in many others, or in the laborious strumming of a guitar. Years ago, I tried to free myself from him and went from the mythologies of the suburbs to the games with time and of infinity. But those games belong to Borges now, and I shall have to imagine other things. Thus my life is a flight, and I lose everything, and everything belongs to oblivion or to him. I do not know which of us has written this page. He had a passion for concentration in subjects that he suddenly became interested in, an overwhelming, all-consuming passion. When he was young, it was dinosaurs, and then tigers, and then Greek mythology, and he would just give up everything and surrender to these passions, which this intensity of concentration followed him through his entire life. He was perverse and contradicted himself, and he never wanted to write something that anybody else had written. He wanted to do his own things. He admired Chesterton, would always praise Chesterton's Father Brown stories, for example. But when he came to write his own story, he wrote Father Brown stories, but in absolute reverse. In Chesterton's stories, Father Brown faces a mystery that appears to have no realistic explanation. It's a miracle, or it's an imagined fantasy or a dream. And at the end of the story, Father Brown points out that the things have perfectly reasonable, realistic explanations. Borges did just this the opposite in his Death in the Compass. We start off with the most commonplace and boring series of murders, but in the end, instead of being solved, you disappear into the realm of metaphysics when Landrot comes to face Red Sherlock. He had a need to be different in so many ways. Other people understood this. And Borges' brother-in-law, who married his sister Nora, had this to say to them. They were not ever good friends, but this is an awfully good take on Borges' view of things. Borges had an attitude of innate distrust of anything affirmative and a perverse preference for doubts and perplexities of a philosophical as well as aesthetic nature. And that says a lot in one sentence. He had another friend, Ulysses Petit de Murat, who commented to me once, "What I think about Borges is that he has an absolute abhorrence for the commonplace." And that's part of his genius. Without going into depth in his style, he had a particular passion for using words in their basic etymological sense, which it's a surprise. He comes up so often with surprising adjectives, and you don't know where they're from unless you know the roots that he was aware he was pointing out. I came back again to Argentina in 67 to 68 with a Fulbright grant to teach American literature in Buenos Aires, something Borges and I shared because he taught American literature in Buenos Aires, and I taught American literature in English in Buenos Aires also. During that year, it was a very wonderful year because he would invite me to come to his home every day. He would go off to the library, the National Library, which was given to him. He was named director when Perón was overthrown. He had always been outspoken against Perón, always. And there were threats made against him and bombs were placed here and there. And on one occasion, Borges, his poor mother, got a phone call from this Peronist justicialista. Says, "Senora, your husband has been constantly criticizing and downplaying the importance of our leader, Perón. We're going to kill both him and you." Click, the phone. And she said, wait. And she says, "I have some advice for you." She says, "My son walks through the streets of Buenos Aires. He's blind. You'll have a cane, but you'll find him, and he'll be easy to get. But I am 95 years old, and I don't have much time left. So if you want me, you better hurry." Then she went. she went click. Yeah, that was. She was quite a person. I never knew anybody quite so sensible. Could see through all the false stuff right to the heart, to the core of something. She was a wonderful person, and lived to the age of 99. They had a very small apartment. They had a maid. In Argentina, they call them mucamas. She was a woman from the provinces, Indian blood, no education. And as the years wore on, she began to take over nursing the mother and preparing Borges for his day. The bath, laid out his clothes for him and so forth. Fanny was always a wonderful person. And Borges would have me come over in the morning to the house. I'd visit his mother. I always brought her a yellow rose in the morning. She was always in bed. And then she would hand me out of her closet Borges's composition notebooks, which I spent hours and hours and hours going through. And a lot of them he gave to me. He says, "I haven't had no interest in this stuff." And one day I found a copy of Inquisiciones, which was his first book of essays. And I also found that day a copy of Discusión, which was his first book of essays published after 1930. And he came home from the library, and I said, "Borges, I found this is Inquisiciones, and this is Discusión." He said, "When I said, this is Discusión," I said, "Yes." He says, "It's yours." And he says, "What is this? This is Inquisiciones." In Argentina, most books are published in paperback. A bound book is very unusual in Argentina. He says, "This is Inquisiciones." "Yes." He tore it in half. And he said, "Fanny, throw this down the garbage chute." And I just rolled my eyes like that. But he did. He wrote three books of essays in the 20s, at the beginning of his career, and forswore them all. He would never allow them to be reprinted in his lifetime and would go around to the bookshops trying to find copies and burn them. But he looked back over his first decade of writing as a mistake. He was trying to be very Argentine, very poetically imaginative in the style of the Ultraist, which was a Spanish literary clique. Sort of, they thought that modernism was overdone and boring and all the rest. They tried to become Ultraist. and Borges later talked about the ultraist, la secta ultraista equivocada. He was on the wrong path. But after 1930, everything he wrote has been included in the Obras Completas of Borges. From the information that I was able to take in 67, 68, I began to build up a nice accumulation of materials and ideas that a lot of people didn't have. But I also had back then many of his friends to talk with about him. And everybody was very generous about telling his or her opinion of Borges. The time when I met him in Buenos Aires was 1962. And I think he was just finishing up being Borges. 1921 to 1960, let's say, when he did his last important book called El Hacedor, The Maker. Well, in English, they call it Dream Tigers for some reason. He was being Borges in all those years. And when I first met him, I realized that his real career was done. He could no longer compose because of his blindness. He could no longer read. If he wanted to read, someone would read to him. If he wanted to write, he could not write stereos anymore because it's a very complicated matter. But he could compose, memorize poetry, and then dictate that. So from the time I met him on, he was being, quote, Borges. He had created a reputation, and now it's like somebody building a golf course. You can't play golf anymore, you have to keep up the golf course. And his destiny took a turn in 1961 when he was given the first Formenter Prize, International Editor's Prize, in Palma de Mallorca. Five publishing houses from five countries, and Borges was given the prize to share with Samuel Beckett. Well, nobody had ever heard of Borges before, but in all these countries, they brought out a Borges book. And Labyrinth was just emerging in the same time. So when our book came out, there was another book called Ficciones, but in English, and the reviewers took the two books on and reviewed them both. I think if they'd gotten one book by a guy named Borges, unknown from Argentina, they may not have paid attention, but the reviews really indicated the critics were learning something about this man whose origins, Argentina at the far edges of the Western Hemisphere, and he was enormously talented. So from 60 to 1, I think Borges was becoming, in quotes, Borges. He taught by invitation at Texas in 1961. He was invited to Texas. They asked him to come. In 1967, 68, he was invited to Harvard. He accepted. But when in 1965 Borges came here and spent a week in October of 75, he asked me if he could come back for a longer period of time. He visited this campus in 69. He came with his new wife. He married once in 67, and his new wife, Elsa, was with him. And she had been widowed at an early age, had a son, was very poor, but he had courted her 40 years before. Now, she was one of the Astetti sisters who used to live in La Plata. And when he met her again, he remembered Elsa from the good old days. He was blind. He didn't know Elsa anymore. But his mother, who was fast approaching 100, decided it was time for Georgi. That's what the friends called him, Georgi. To get married because she couldn't take care of him anymore. So she allowed that, I think. Everybody else said, and the mother was at the fist of steel in the velvet glove and kept him at home for herself. But no, she wanted somebody to take care of him, so she allowed Borges to marry. It lasted 3 years. Yeah. And when Borges came here for the first time in 69, he gave a lecture at the music auditorium with a marvelous audience, so appreciative, and he spoke about his work with his principal translator, a chap by the name of Norman Thomas DiGiovanni. And the next time he came, I had been with him in Argentina and said, would you come to Michigan State if we awarded you a doctor's honorary doctorate? He said, I'd be delighted. So he did. And before he came, he wrote a poem anticipating East Lansing, but without ever having been there for any period of time. This is what he wrote. East Lansing, the days and the nights are interwoven entre tejidos of memory and fear. Fear, one form of hope, and memory, a name that we give to the cracks in oblivion. Time for me has always been a Janus, looking at both the sunset and the dawn. Today I mean to celebrate you, O immediate future, land of the Bible and the axe. Trees I will look toward and not see, breeze carrying birds unknown to me, pleasant cold nights that will sink into dreams and perhaps into my homeland. Light switches and revolving doors that in time will be habitual. Awakenings when I shall tell myself, today is today. Books my hand will recognize, friends who will be voices, western sands of yellow and one color left to me. All this I sing, and I also sing the unbearable memory of places in Buenos Aires and those where I can never be happy. On the eve of my visit, I sing your twilight, East Lansing. I know these words I am dictating may be exact, yet subtly false, because reality cannot be grasped, because language is a series of rigid symbols. Michigan, Indiana, Wisconsin, Iowa, Texas, Colorado, Arizona. I shall try to sing them all. He came in March of 72, received his doctorate, and we set up a lecture at Fairchild Auditorium. And it was the night of a horrible ice storm. Bob, do you remember that? There was an ice storm, and all of the telephone wires were encased in ice, and ice every place on the ground. Fairchild Auditorium was filled that night. And he was so pleased and smiled the entire time during the lecture and received his doctorate from Clifton Wharton. And they had a special reception for him at Kellogg Center. That was the second time that he came. He came again in 75. Bill Johnson was there in 1965 when, this is an interesting story, I have a little bit of time. Alan Hollingsworth, chairman of the English department in summer of 1975, called me over and said, let me invite you to lunch. Wow, I don't know Alan Hollingsworth. He had a deal. He was planning to dedicate the English department's annual literature conference to Borges. I didn't know that. He says, that's my plan. He says, I'm going to give you a ticket and your expenses. Go to Buenos Aires and get Borges' commitment to come back for a week in October. So I went down and started. He was surprised to see me there. But I said, well, I have something special I want to do down here. And I began asking questions. I said, are you going to be free in October, October 2nd to 4th? He said, oh, no, I can't do that. I said, why? He says, because I am giving a series of lectures at the Bonnardiel Art Gallery, lectures prepaid by people who want to attend. And the series goes right through that weekend. I have a little folder which I call Intercepting Borges, which tells how I was able to do it. I kept insisting, talk to his mother, talk to his friends. And then he started asking questions. He said, how long did you say this was going to be? He said, who's going to be there? And I said, important people, Anderson Embert and John Barth is going to be there. And finally, I knew that he was thinking about it. Finally, he said, yes, I will come. So I left him in Buenos Aires and came back to East Lansing for the fall term. He always had to travel with somebody. He couldn't travel alone. So this time, his nephews were not available. His mother was too feeble. So he looked around, and there was a young student who had started studying with him Anglo-Saxon. Because when Borges went blind, he said, I have to find something to do. So he decided to get a group of students to study something that was new to him, and it was Anglo-Saxon. A young Japanese Argentine woman by the name of Maria Kodama accompanied him, her first trip with him, and it was to East Lansing. And he had a wonderful time. As I told you, he asked me if he could come back for longer. I says, yes. Winter terms the next time. He says, I'll come back. So I went to Metro Airport in Detroit and picked up Borges Maria Kodama January 2nd of 1976, and he spent 4 months here in East Lansing giving two classes and giving a series of lectures, public lectures at, what's the auditorium, Bob?
Fairchild.
Anthony Hall is correct, that's right. And the topics of the topics of the lectures were Walt Whitman's experiment, the author of Beowulf, The Nightmare, Emanuel Swedenborg, and Blindness, with huge and appreciative audiences there. And we did a lot of traveling. He had to give his classes, but we always moved travel around the classes, and there were so many invitations from everywhere. And Borges went east, he went west, he went south. And I tried to carry through with the friends who asked me to sign Borges up for Iowa, for Emory, for UCLA. And apparently I failed to comply with friends who thought Borges shouldn't be going to Hope College or shouldn't be going to Albion or shouldn't be going to Toledo to give lectures and receive degrees. He should be going to the East Coast, particularly Ivy schools. So something was in the air, and I didn't realize it. But when Borges and Maria packed up and went back to Buenos Aires at the end of the winter term in 76, I got a letter. And I'm sure it was typed by Maria Kodama, because he never learned to type. And he asked me, which was incredible, for an accounting of the finances, because there must have been $25,000 to $30,000 that would be accumulated. And he had never asked me about any accounting or with anybody else. Norman Thomas Giovanni, his translator, I always got 50%. I never asked for anything. I didn't want anything. Finally, he said, no, I insist. Take the checks that you have that you haven't cashed yet and take half. And I said, all right, I'll do that. He never was interested in finances. And then I had another trip planned. Joanne and I had been married in 77, and we were going to Argentina for several months. And before I left, I got a letter in the mail from Borges, and it said, I now understand that our friendship has come to an end. Buenos Aires is a very large and populous city. I see no reason we have to see each other when you and Joanne come here. I congratulate you on your marriage to Joanne, and I wish you success with your biography. You may wish not to mention this letter to anyone. He says, I certainly will not. Privacy and discretion are two hobbies of mine. Period. Jorge Luis Borges. And I've never been able to find out what it was, but when we went to Buenos Aires, I talked to friends of his and said, couldn't you prevail? I can't imagine. Borges also said in the letter, I'll never give you the reason, so don't expect that I will explain to you why this has happened. Never was able to speak to him again. And that ended for me a period in my knowledge and a friendship with Borges. And as time went on, Maria Kodama became more and more involved in his life. And his mother, who had died in 75, for some reason felt in her heart that this woman was not right for Borges. And she told Fanny, the maid, who told me later, she said to Fanny. Be careful about that. She used an unfortunate term, piel amarilla, that yellow skin. Be careful. Watch out for her. Se va a quedar con todo. She's going to end up with everything. Now, that's not the Maria Colom I knew when she was here. Always available for Borges. They'd be out until 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night, a lecture, go home. Borges wants somebody to read to him. She reads to him until the sun comes up or whatever. Very attentive and very generous and perfect. But something happened in the meantime, I guess. So Borges spent, after 77, spent the next 9 years with Maria Colom. She became more and more involved. And every trip he took now was with Maria Colom. And his friends began to fall away, friends whom he had depended on for a long, long time. Close friends, Bioy Casares, he used to have dinner practically every night with him at his home, and he was not appearing there. And he broke up with his family, his sister, Nora, and her sons over a mistake in the dealing, the nephews dealing with the bank account, which they all shared together, never spoke to them again, even though there was no harm done, whatever, it was a mistake. Never spoke to them. Spoke to her only once on the evening of a Saturday. He invited her for dinner at a restaurant across from his home in downtown Buenos Aires. They had dinner. And she was surprised because he hadn't spoken to her for 3 years. But the next day, he went to a book signing at a booksellers in Buenos Aires, and he and Bioy Casares, his old friend, were there together one last time. Borges said nothing to anyone. He had been diagnosed with liver cancer. And he left with Maria Colom the next day. Nobody knew anything about it, even the people who had him at the bookshop, even a person he had an appointment with the next day to do an interview, knew nothing about it. They went off to Europe, first to Italy, and then back to Geneva, where he had had his early schooling. And still alert, still working. They were married in April of 86. He was terribly, very, very ill. But there's no way he could have been married because when he and Elsa separated, they didn't have divorce. So that was a false ruse through diplomatic doings. And they were married by proxy in a small town, lost and gone in the backlands of Paraguay by proxy. And Borges died on the 16th, the 14th of June. In Geneva, and everyone expected that his remains would be returned to Argentina. Maria Colom said that he had expressed the desire not to go back and be buried with his mother in the family vault, but to stay and be buried in Geneva, which was the case, in the Cimetière des Rois in the Plein Palais district of Geneva. Well, years later, in 1996, Joanne and another couple decided to do a month in Europe. And we went to London and Paris and Germany and Austria, Italy, and to Stresa, and then over the Simplon Pass into Switzerland. And our destination was Geneva. And, of course, the first thing I wanted to do was to go to Borges' grave. And we did. We found a guide to where all the grave sites were and the names of the people interred there. And we found Borges' grave right away with its very distinctive Anglo-Saxon motif with a quotation in Anglo-Saxon also. And there it was. And a bed of flowers lay at the foot of the gravestone. And the flowers were sere, dried up. They obviously hadn't, no one had attended to that. And in all the years that I lectured with Borges, I had to make the lecture arrangements, and he always wanted water because it was somehow made him feel comfortable and he could drink water when he was giving his lecture. I went over, there was a fountain and watering cans. And I filled up the watering can, went over, and at that moment I realized I was giving Borges his last watering. And having known him is probably the most important thing in my life. And I care enormously for him, but something happened, and I'm not sure what. But it's not going to keep me from taking the notes that I've gathered and doing a book called Magical Journey. Because I stood there in Geneva with a watering can and thought about Borges in 1918, when the First War finally ended, which had pinned him and his family down in Geneva. When it ended, he took off on what had to be considered a magical journey. They went to France, they went to Spain, they went to Palma de Mallorca, they went back to Buenos Aires, and Borges traced out a career that is without match in the history of literature, for reasons that I've said, for the characteristics that he displayed. So, Magical Journey is the title of the book, and it was a magical journey, and the book will describe that magical journey. And that's all for now. Thank you very much. Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
We have some refreshments here if you'd like to stay and have some chats.
Sure, I'll stay here and answer any questions. Be delighted to do that.
And have some refreshments.
Yeah.